You knew damn well I was a snake before you took me in. Does that make sense to anybody? Does that make any sense?
When the economy and the real estate market plummeted in 1990, attorney Alan Pomerantz says Trump owed $4 billion to his debtors, including that $1 billion for which he was personally responsible.
Because he personally guaranteed so much debt, the leverage shifted dramatically over to the banks, because it was no longer an issue of a bank and a piece of real estate. It was a bank and Donald Trump's actual survival.
Trump owed money all over town to 72 banks in all. Pomerantz represented them as a group.
How close was he to going personally bankrupt?
Very.
Trump makes a point of saying he never went personally bankrupt. But there's a reason why the banks decided to keep Trump whole.
We made the decision that he would be worth more alive to us than dead.
In the 90s, Donald Trump was bailed out by Rothschild, Inc. Wilbur Ross, senior managing director of Rothschild, is now Commerce Secretary of the United States. The Rothschilds, one of the wealthiest families in the world, founded Israel. The Balfour Declaration in 1917, Britain signed over Palestine to Walter Rothschild to create a Jewish state.
This is the desk where the Balfour Declaration was composed and written.
Funny you should say that.
It is.
And here it is, the Balfour Declaration. What do you feel when you see it here?
I genuinely feel it's one of the most extraordinary moments in the history of the Jewish people. If you think it took 3,000 years to get to this.
We love Israel. We will fight for Israel 100%, 1,000%. It will be there forever. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
We kept him alive to help us.
Not only is Trump being financed today by Jewish billionaires, but he was also bailed out by the Rothschilds who founded Israel. He's not playing them. He has been close to them for a very long time. We know today that Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction. Who lied about Iraq having WMDs and convinced Congress to support preemptively bombing Iraq?
And every indication we have is that he is pursuing with abandon, pursuing with every ounce of effort, the establishment of weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear weapons. There is no question whatsoever that Saddam is seeking and is working and is advancing towards the development of nuclear weapons. No question whatsoever. I have to say that in the history of democracies, preemption has been, in my mind, the most difficult choice for leaders to make. Because at the time of the decision, you could never prove the critics wrong. You could never show them the great catastrophe that was avoided by preemptive action. And yet we now know that had the democracies taken preemptive action to bring down Hitler in the 1930s, the worst horrors in history could have been avoided.
I think your statement, which is very eloquent, boils down to one thing, and that is, do we react to another attack on America after hundreds of thousands or millions of lives have been lost, or do we preempt that kind of action from happening in the first place? And I think you made a very strong case today that we should support President Bush and respond before it happens.
The main reason we went into Iraq at the time was we thought he had weapons of mass destruction. It turns out he didn't, but he had the capacity to make weapons of mass destruction. But I also talked about the human suffering in Iraq. The terrorists attacked us and killed 3,000 of our citizens. before we started the freedom agenda in the Middle East. They were... What did Iraq have to do with what?
The attack on the World Trade Center.
Nothing.
Israel lied about Iraq having weapons of mass destruction and that Iraq was harboring terrorists. Where did these lies originate?
Of Saddam's attempts to conceal and deceive the world, to conceal the efforts that he's making at producing weapons of mass destruction. We in Israel have known this for a long time.
In 1981, Netanyahu wrote a book called International Terrorism, advocating for the West, led by the United States, to wage war against Iraq on the basis of weapons of mass destruction. He also pushed for war with Libya and Iran. He wrote all of this 20 years before Bush was in office. Israel knew Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction. Yossi Sarid, member of the Israeli Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee in 2004, admitted it was known in Israel the story that weapons of mass destruction could be activated in 45 minutes was an old wives' tale. I think an old wives' tale is the best way to describe it. The Iraq War is often described as the greatest intelligence failure in living memory. Well, who gave that intelligence to the United States?
To conceal the efforts that he's making at producing weapons of mass destruction, we in Israel have known this for a long time. We've shared this intelligence with the United States.
We have some evidence to that effect.
You know, I was asked the same question in 1986. I had written a book in which I had said that the way to deal with terrorist regimes, well, with terror, was to deal with the terrorist regimes. And the way to deal with the terrorist regimes, among other things, was to apply military force against them.
In 1986, Netanyahu wrote another book. This one is called Terrorism, How the West Can Win. He wrote about Iraq having weapons of mass destruction again, and also advocated for the West to wage war against Iraq, Libya, Syria, Yemen, Iran, North Korea, and Cuba. With the exception of Cuba, all of this is happening today. All this was launched just more than a week after 9/11.
And right after 9/11, about 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the Joint Staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, "No." He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. He picked up a piece of paper and he said, "I just got this down from upstairs," meaning the Secretary of Defense's office, today. And he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out seven countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran."
But September 11th put it in a different light, and taking on that tyrant forcefully meant, in fact, if anything, that we had to take that threat more seriously. So all three of those concerns are stated in Secretary Powell's testimony. Now, I talked about the mistreatment of the people.
Let me interrupt because my time is limited, unfortunately. You just said that this is that 10 years ago you wouldn't have agreed to a regime change. However, in 1998, you as a member of the New American Century sent a letter to President
Senator,
Clinton.
I said something different. Well,
now, wait a sec. You were saying we're seeing it in the light of September 11th. That's just not true. You've been advocating for regime change all through the late 90s. And in this letter,
Can I explain? There's
strategy
a very clear
difference. Should aim above all. This is 1998. The strategy should aim above all at the removal of Saddam Hussein's regime from power. You signed that letter.
Former Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz pushed for war against Iraq in 1998. Claiming that they were going to use weapons of mass destruction on Israel. He was also involved in planning the countries to wage war against after 9/11, as General Wesley Clark revealed. Paul Wolfowitz is an Israeli-American dual citizen. He lived in Israel when he was 14. He gets in a position where he heavily influences U.S. foreign policy and is openly planning wars for the security of Israel. This comes at the cost of American lives and trillions of dollars of American taxpayer money. He wasn't pushing the people of Israel to fight a war against Iraq. He got the Americans to fight that war instead. Israeli propagandist Dennis Prager even admitted that the United States is fighting wars for Israel, and I don't think anyone has explained it better than he has.
We Jews are the world's miner's canary. In 1973, I was on a St. Louis radio station during the Arab oil embargo. And a non-Jewish caller called up and he said the following. He said, you know, I don't understand. You Jews seem to be the tail that wags the dog. You want America to take great concern over the Jews of Russia and exacerbate tensions with the other superpower? You want us to help Israel and have hostile, therefore more hostile relations with those who have our oil? What gives with you Jews? Are you the tail that wags the dog? It took the World Trade Center bombing to take Hamas seriously in America. It's too bad. Maybe had we taken it seriously sooner, a few families would have had their fathers and brothers and sons in New York. My friends, the enemies of Israel are not the Boy Scouts of the world. The enemies of Israel is Iran, which is destroying its Baha'is, Sudan, which actually crucifies blacks. New York Times article a couple of months ago, but didn't get to see that on CNN. Iraq, which is a living concentration camp for its own people. Syria, which destroyed 20,000 of its own citizens in just one fairly well-known operation a few years ago. Hamas, whose agenda is the destruction of anyone who opposes their theocracy. Those are the enemies of Israel. They are also the enemies of good people. It is not a position we Jews asked for, but when we make this known to non-Jews, they will understand why we are here. Thank you very much.
Valerie Plame, former CIA operative, linked to an article on Twitter today titled, I want to read this, America's Jews are driving America's wars.
Former CIA officer Valerie Plame tweeted an article called America's Jews are driving America's wars. This sparked controversy and she was forced to resign from the Plowshares Fund. That article was actually written by Philip Giraldi, who is another former CIA officer. He also wrote about the Israelis being arrested for filming and celebrating as the first tower was hit. Back to the original article. Giraldi writes that most of the neoconservatives who control U.S. foreign policy are Jewish. He goes on to list many of their names. Nearly all the Iran haters are Jewish. David Frum, Max Boot, Bill Kristol, Brett Stevens. And I would like to add a few more names. Mark Dubowitz, Michael Ledeen, Reuel Marc Gerecht of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Daniel Pipes of the Middle East Forum, John Potteretz of Commentary Magazine, Elliot Abrams of the Council on Foreign Relations, Mayrab Wormser of the Middle East Research Institute, Kimberly Kagan of the Institute for the Study of War, Frederick Kagan, Daniel Pletka, and David Wormser of the American Enterprise Institute. And yep, they're all Jewish. Plus, most of them would self-describe as neoconservatives. And I might add that only one of the named individuals has ever served in any branch of the American military. One might also add that neocons, as a group, were founded by Jews and are largely Jewish, hence their universal attachment to the State of Israel. Paul Wolfowitz, Doug Feith, and Scooter Libby. Yes, all Jewish and all conduits for the false information that led to a war that has spread and effectively destroyed much of the Middle East, except for Israel, of course. Philip Zelikow, also Jewish, in a moment of candor, admitted that the Iraq War, in his opinion, was fought for Israel. Is anyone providing an alternative viewpoint to eternal and uncritical support for Benjamin Netanyahu and his kleptocratic regime of racist thugs? I think not. After writing this article, Giraldi was fired by the American Conservative, where he had been a regular contributor for 14 years.
that brought us low economically, morally. We went to war against a guy who had absolutely nothing to do with 9/11. It was a total pretext. It's inexplicable. And there you go to Cheney, there you go to Bush, there you go to the Jewish neocons who wanted to remake the world. Maybe I can say that because I'm Jewish, and to bring about a certain result
to
the Middle East.
I'm not really sure that you can.
Okay.
I'm not really sure that you can.
Go ahead.
Most of the neoconservatives who control U.S. foreign policy are in fact Jewish. This is even admitted in one of the biggest Israeli news outlets, Haaretz. Israel is not burdened with trillions of dollars of debt. The United States is.
We American Jews have the most extraordinary rights in this remarkable country. With those rights comes responsibilities.
On our Independence Line, John, good morning for Michael Schreuer.
Good morning. I, for one, am sick and tired of all these Jews coming on C-SPAN and other stations and pushing us to go to war against our Muslim friends. They're willing to spend the last drop of American blood and treasure to get their way in the world. They have way too much power in this country. People like Wolfowitz and Fife and the other neocons that jewed us into Iraq. And now we're going to spend the next 60 years rehabilitating our soldiers. I'm sick and tired of it.
John in Franklin, New York. Any comments?
Yeah, I think that, of course, American foreign policy is eventually up to the American people. One of the big things that we've not been able to discuss in this country for the last 30 years is our policy toward the Israelis. Whether we want to be involved in fighting Israel's wars in the future is something that Americans should be able to talk about. They may vote yes. They may want to see their kids killed in Iraq or Yemen or somewhere else to protect Israel. But the question is, we need to talk about it. Ultimately, Israel as a country is of no particular worth to the United States.
It doesn't, you mean strategically?
Strategically. We have no, they have no resources we need. Their manpower is minimal. Their association with us is a negative for the United States. Now, that's a fact.
IASPS is a Jerusalem-based think tank with an office in Washington, D.C. for its Israeli-American dual citizens. In 1996, they wrote the Clean Break policy paper for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. This called for the destabilization of Iraq and Syria. In 2001, three of them got top positions in the Bush administration. Richard Perle, Chairman of the Defense Policy Board. Douglas Feith, Undersecretary of Defense. David Wormser, Middle East advisor to Dick Cheney. This was a study group on a new Israeli strategy towards 2000. Benjamin Netanyahu's government comes in with a new set of ideas. Work closely with Turkey and Jordan to contain, destabilize, and roll back some of its most dangerous threats. This implies a clean break from the slogan, comprehensive peace, to a traditional concept of strategy based on a balance of power. Israel can shape its strategic environment in cooperation with Turkey and Jordan by weakening, containing, and even rolling back Syria. This effort can focus on removing Saddam Hussein from power, an important Israeli strategic objective in its own right. Israeli citizens working in the U.S. government officially planned the wars in Iraq and Syria for the interest of Israel in 1996 and 1998. If this is all too hard to believe, Douglas Feith admits the Clean Break policy paper is legit on his own website. He just puts all the blame on David Wormser. David's wife, Mayrab Wormser, another one of the authors, was interviewed by BBC about the Clean Break, and she also confirmed its legitimacy.
Done in a think tank by a group of people. Yes, many of us are Jewish. There's no need to apologize for that. Most of us, all of us, in fact, are pro-Israel. Some of us more fiercely so than others.
Well, that paper in 1996, the Clean Break paper, that was the paper that led to accusations of dual loyalty.
There is no dual loyalty.
President Nixon disallowed Jewish advisors from discussing Israel policy. Nixon ordered his aides to exclude all Jewish Americans from policy making on Israel, according to formally classified notes taken by then Chief of Staff H.R. Bob Haldeman on a meeting with the president in July 1971. No Jew can handle the Israeli thing. Forget the Jews. They're against the administration. People may call Nixon an anti-Semite, but he was right.
Listening in agreement is the Reverend Billy Graham.
This stranglehold has got to be broken, or this country is going to go down the drain.
Do you believe that?
Yes, sir.
I can never say it, but I believe it.
Iraq it was the perfect test case to create a vibrant democracy in the heart of the Arab world. I mean, this is a basically educated population. We completely underestimated the level of sectarianism there. But again, is easily ascribed to incompetence.
Sam Harris and other idiots will claim that Iraq was invaded to spread democracy and that the disastrous outcome was a mistake. It wasn't a mistake. That was the intended policy, to destabilize the country. Dick Cheney even admitted in 1994 that he knew Iraq would be destabilized if Saddam was taken out, and they did it anyway.
Do you think that the U.S. or U.N. forces should have moved into Baghdad?
No.
Why not?
Once you got to Iraq and took it over and took down Saddam Hussein's government, then what are you going to put in its place? That's a very volatile part of the world, and if you take down the central government in Iraq, you can easily end up seeing pieces of Iraq fly off. Part of it the Syrians would like to have to the west, part of eastern Iraq the Iranians would like to claim, fought over for 8 years. In the north, you've got the Kurds, and if the Kurds spin loose and join with the Kurds in Turkey, then you threaten the territorial integrity of Turkey. It's a quagmire if you go that far and try to take over Iraq.
If you take out Saddam's regime, I guarantee you that it will have enormous positive reverberations on the region.
The goal for both of them, the goal for the United States, is twofold, as I've stated. It's one, to make sure that we destabilize Syria. I needed to make sure that I clarified and not was in any way, shape, or form any more of a distraction from the president's decisive action in Syria and the attempts that he's making to destabilize the region.
AFEC Oil and Gas confirmed that major oil reserves were found in the Golan Heights. AFEC Oil and Gas is a subsidiary of Genie Energy. Genie Energy's strategic advisory board includes Fox News' Rupert Murdoch and Jacob Rothschild, whose family founded Israel. Another board member is former Vice President Dick Cheney, who played a major role in destabilizing the Middle East. The Golan Heights is Syrian territory that is illegally occupied by Israel. It was stolen from Syria during the Six-Day War, when Israel preemptively attacked Egypt, Jordan, Syria, and the United States. You'll often hear that the Arabs tried to drive the Jews into the sea. That is a proven lie. The Israelis tried to drive Americans into the sea with rockets and napalm. It's no longer tolerable to take someone else's land by force. Hitler occupied Poland, then Britain and France declared a world war. Israel has occupied all of its neighbors, Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, Palestine, slaughtering civilians in the process, while world leaders look the other way. The president of Genie, Ephraim Itam, is actually a Jewish supremacist. As an Israeli lawmaker in the Knesset, he publicly called for expelling Palestinians from the West Bank, which is their own land, their private property, and turn it into a place where only Jewish people can live. He was never reprimanded and continued working for the Israeli government for years. Afterwards, he went on to make millions. If you're Jewish, you're allowed to say racist and xenophobic things. But if you criticize Jews, they ruin your career. This is Jewish privilege. After saying Jews are responsible for all the wars in the world, Mel Gibson knew that day that his life was fucked. General Energy controls the oil in the Kurdistan region of Iraq. General Energy was founded by Nathaniel Rothschild. So Israel officially plans to destabilize Iraq and Syria, Then the founding family of Israel owns oil companies in both countries. Israel actually gets 77% of its oil from Iraqi Kurdistan. I think a more appropriate title would be, after Saddam removed from power, Israel gets 77% of its oil from Iraq. Sometimes you have to ask yourself who benefits. Israel clearly benefited from overthrowing Saddam. Meanwhile, it was one of the greatest strategic disasters in American history. That was American blood being spilled. That oil is going to Israel. And don't forget about all the kids that the soldiers were manipulated into bombing. This was a disaster for Europe as well. Destabilizing Iraq and Syria for Israel created 13.6 million refugees. And that's just in 2014. The number is way higher now. Most of the refugees go to Europe, and none go to Israel, who was next door and started the conflict. Prior to the Islamic Revolution in 1979, when the Shah was overthrown, Israel got most of its oil from Iran by way of the Trans-Israel Pipeline. Israel also benefited as the pipeline would export oil through to Europe. If there's regime change in Iran, all that oil will start flowing to Israel again. The pipeline in Israel was actually financed by Baron Edmund de Rothschild. What a coincidence. Netanyahu wants regime change in Iraq, Syria, and Iran. The founding family of Israel has oil interests in all three. There is a connection. Netanyahu worked for the Boston Consulting Group from 1976 to 1978. He worked with Michael Rothschild, who was there at the same time. Thanks to investigative journalist Christopher Wolin for this information. Now we're going to look at a strategy for Israel in the 1980s, written by Israeli scholar Oded Yinon in 1982. Some of you may know this as the Oded Yinon Plan or the Greater Israel Project. This was translated to English by Professor Israel Shahak and published in a book titled The Zionist Plan for the Middle East. Iraq rich in oil on one hand and internally torn on the other. Every kind of inter-Arab confrontation will assist us. This is exactly what's happening today. Again, Israel plans to destabilize Iraq and Syria, then has oil companies operating in them. The dissolution of Syria and Iraq later on into ethnically or religiously unique areas such as Lebanon is Israel's primary target on the Eastern Front in the long run. In Iraq, a division into provinces along ethnic religious lines, as in Syria during Ottoman times, is possible. So the three or more states will exist around the three major cities, Basra, Baghdad, and Mosul, and Shiite areas in the south will separate from the Sunni and Kurdish north. Retired Colonel Rolf Peters, who was a hardcore Zionist, published a map in the Armed Forces Journal in 2006 that suggests reimagining Middle Eastern borders on ethnic, sectarian, and tribal lines. Notice the Kurdish state in the north.
As fighting between Iraq's rival factions splinters the country, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu voiced his support for Kurdish statehood.
Regarding the Kurds, they are a fighting people that have proved their political commitment, political moderation, and deserve political independence.
Israel has quietly maintained military and intelligence ties with the Kurds for decades, seeing in the minority ethnic group a buffer against shared Arab adversaries.
We should support international efforts to strengthen Jordan and support the Kurdish aspiration for independence.
Israel endorses Kurdish independence. With everything Israel has done to the Middle East, Iraq won't allow this to happen. The Kurdish independence referendum was successfully passed. This is Israeli strategic thinking, the idea that all Arab states should be broken down by Israel into small units. After 35 years, this is being accomplished. Iran closed its borders with Kurdistan out of respect for Iraq's territorial integrity. Syria rejects Kurdistan's referendum as it undermines Iraq's unity. Iraq announced sanctions on Kurdistan following the referendum. Turkey does not care about its neighbor's unity and has worked with Israel at the start of this conflict. They've been fighting with the Kurds for decades and don't want a Kurdish state beside them. Turkey is ready for war, which is what Israel and Cheney were expecting to happen.
you will always be divided. And as long as you're divided, you'll be weak. And as long as you are weak, they'll steal your wealth. It's not rocket science. You don't have to be Einstein to work it out. Unity is strength. If you could only stop thinking like Sunni and Shia, like Lebanese and Syrian, like left and right, like Maghrebi or Levantine, if you could, or Gulfi, if you could only stop thinking like that, imagine the strength that you could have if you came together. But as long as you are ready to sit and blame other people, you will never be united. And as long as you are not united, you will be divided. And as long as you are divided, they will steal your things. That's why they're doing it. They just care about dividing you. They just care about making you fight against each other. As long as you're fighting each other, you're not fighting them. You're not fighting Israel. You're allowing them to steal your oil, steal your gas, steal your water.
This is divide and conquer. Israeli Justice Minister Ayelet Shaked admitted that Israel has major interest in a Kurdish state. She claims that the West does too. No, we don't. We need to stay the hell out of the Middle East.
انت يمكن خايف المشكل بينك وبين هالزلمه عم تحله بس انت ما عم تخدم هذا المشروع انت ما عم تخدم حقك انت عم تخدم اللي عم بيدعمك وعم بيسلحك هلا هن عم بيصوروا لكم هذا الشيء عم يشربوا لكم اياه هي مش هيك كليا الحرب هلا قال لك شو هي قال لك شو هي اسرائيل وكل شيء انا وياك اذا بنضبح بعضنا عم يشرب ويسكي هذا اخر همه
The United States and Israeli governments have been arming ISIS to fight against Syria and its allies for much of the last 6 years. Now with ISIS diminishing, how do you keep the conflict going? Trump is arming the Kurds in Syria and Iraq, and Israel is now giving air support to the Kurds to fight against its neighbors. Trump is continuing Obama's foreign policy towards Israel, but far more hawkish. People actually thought this was going to change.
Today I have the honor of welcoming my friend, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, to the White House. With this visit, the United States again reaffirms our unbreakable bond with our cherished ally, Israel.
And he would have Iran run Syria, a horrible prospect for us, or Daesh, which is also there, touching our borders on the Golan. When two of your enemies are fighting each other, I don't say strengthen one or the other. I say weaken both, or at least don't intervene, which is what I've done. I've not intervened. I have acted several years ago, and I think I was the first country to do that, to put a military hospital 10 yards away from our border with the Golan, with Syria.
Okay, you say no preference. There have been reports that Israel has been treating wounded Syrian rebel fighters in its hospitals on the border, including fighters from Nusra Front, which is, of course, the al-Qaeda proxy in Syria. Do those reports worry you that Israel's helping wounded al-Qaeda-aligned fighters?
As I said before, in a different context, it's always useful also to deal with your enemies in a humane way.
ISIS is beheading Muslims and Christians than receiving medical treatment from Israel. If they were attacking Jews, they would not be receiving medical treatment. The former director of Mossad goes on television claiming that these psychopaths who are beheading people deserve humane treatment because they have never attacked Israel.
Al-Qaeda, to the best of my recollection, has up to now not attacked Israel.
But it's attacked your number one ally and protector and sponsor, the United States of America. There is a quote-unquote war on terror being going on for 15 years.
The only time they attacked Israel was by accident and they apologized, which former Defense Minister Moshe Alon publicly admitted. When ISIS attacks superpowers like France or Britain, they don't apologize. Why do they travel thousands of miles to kill civilians in Europe when Israel is just a couple miles away? ISIS actually explained why it's not attacking Israel. The Islamic State said in its weekly newspaper that it has not focused on attacking Israel because it does not believe the Palestinian cause is more significant than other issues affecting Muslims. ISIS is burning Palestinian flags. ISIS is beheading and raping Palestinians. An ISIS leader was arrested in Libya and was discovered to be a Mossad agent.
You tell the story about how you tried to find out what they call the Mossad when they deal with publicly?
I thought it was a reasonable question, but the trouble is you can't pick up the phone book. There's no Langley in Israel that you can look up, you know, CIA or in our case the Mossad. We thought we should ask, what shall we call it in English? You can translate the Hebrew words, as I said, Mossad is institute. But when they write a letter to their friends in the CIA or the British intelligence, what do they call themselves? It took a while. It was a matter of asking the prime minister's spokesman. The best you could do, because officially the Mossad is under the prime minister's office. And I think he sort of wondered why you want to know and all that, so we explained. And he came up with the Israeli Secret Intelligence Service. And if it were to have initials, it would be ISIS.
It's not Israel's battle, it's your battle. It's the battle of France. Because it's the same battle. If they succeed here, if Israel is the one that's blamed here and not the terrorists, if we don't stand together, then this terror plague will come to you. It's just a question of time. It will come to you, it will come to France.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told French Jews Saturday, after 17 people were killed there during 3 days of Islamist attacks, that Israel is their home. In a televised statement, Netanyahu said, "To all the Jews of France, all the Jews of Europe, I would like to say that Israel is not just the place in whose direction you pray. The state of Israel is your home." Media sources say that Netanyahu has also ordered a ministerial committee to convene next week to discuss ways to encourage immigration of French and other European Jews to Israel.
ISIS and Israel both attack Palestinians. ISIS attacks Syrian forces. Israel airstrikes Syrian forces. ISIS attacks Hezbollah. Israel airstrikes Hezbollah. ISIS attacks all of Israel's enemies regularly, but has never attacked Israel. Israel is supposedly the only democracy in the Middle East, with Western values and freedom that these people hate.
Look, ISIS got started through funding from our friends and allies, because as people will tell you in the region, if you want somebody who will fight to the death against Hezbollah, you don't put out a recruiting poster and say, you know, sign up for us, we're going to make a better world. You go after zealots, and you go after these religious fundamentalists. That's who fights Hezbollah.
We have been fighting alongside Al-Qaeda, fighting alongside ISIS. ISIS is now emboldened and in two countries. But here's the anomaly. We're with ISIS in Syria. We're on the same side of the war.
When we started the war on terror after 9/11, it was essentially a war against Al-Qaeda and sure. similar
right.
organizations. We have gone full circle from opposing Al-Qaeda, complete circle to where we now supply them, we arm them, we finance them, and it's all coming with the approval of the highest authorities in the United States government.
I think every American would be surprised to know that for years our government has been providing both direct and indirect support to these armed militant groups who are working directly with or even under the command of terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS, all in their effort and fight to overthrow the Syrian government. Our bill does a simple thing, and it says that our taxpayer dollars should not be used.
They already reject ISIL. Do you know any major Arab ally that embraces ISIL?
I know major Arab allies who fund them.
I mean, it was very clear what we were going to face.
Well, I admire your frankness
very
on this
clear
subject.
What we were going to
let
face.
Let me just, before we move on, just to clarify once more, you are basically saying that even in government at the time, you knew those groups were around, you saw this analysis,
sure.
And you were arguing against it. But who wasn't listening?
I think the administration.
So the administration turned a blind eye to your analysis?
I don't know if they turned a blind eye. I think it was a decision. I think it was a willful decision.
Hillary Clinton has described already the meeting in the White House over 2 years ago. Everyone in the national security team recommended arming ISIS.
Was moving too slowly, but the fall of Ramadi has galvanized the Iraqi government. So with the additional steps I ordered last month, we're speeding up training of ISIL forces, including volunteers from Sunni tribes in Anbar province.
Saudi Arabia, Qatar, other Gulf states, Turkey, Jordan, ourselves, Britain, France, all fund, train, support, and ultimately are responsible for these monsters running around in their latest branded name, ISIS, which I will repeat a third time stands for Israeli Secret Intelligence Service.
While serving as defense minister, Mashallah said that he prefers ISIS, terrorists that are going around beheading people, to be in control of Syria, instead of the Syrian government who is allied with Iran. The Israeli government wants ISIS to keep destabilizing Syria and continue pushing refugees to Europe. In 2015, Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman publicly called for disloyal Israeli Arabs to be beheaded. That is essentially what ISIS is doing. After Yalon resigned, Netanyahu asked Lieberman to become the new defense minister, and he accepted.
Professor, you suggested the rather controversial idea that ISIL, for example, which operates both in Syria and in Iraq, should be weakened, but still should be kept alive as a strategic tool that would allow to put pressure on what you call bad guys. And by bad guys, you mean Iran, Hezbollah, but also Syria and Russia. If that's indeed the strategy, do you think we then will have to accept the attacks like the one that happened in Manchester a short while ago as an attendant cost of it?
Well, first of all, I'm happy you are reading my articles. It's true that I have advocated that the campaign against ISIS is problematic because we are weakening an anti-Iranian actor in the region. And also we undermine the ability of the opposition forces in Syria to end this Assad regime. What I'm saying simply is to save our efforts vis-a-vis ISIS and concentrate on the larger threat, which is Iran.
So do I understand you correctly that within your framework, the 22 people who died in Manchester were, you know, collateral damage to that strategy? It's terrible, but people are dying in large numbers in the Middle East, so something like that will have to be accepted.
Professor Ephraim Inbar actually published an article for an Israeli think tank claiming that the destruction of ISIS is a strategic mistake. While acknowledging ISIS has killed thousands, taking over cities and beheading people on video, in his mind, the continuing existence of ISIS serves a strategic purpose because they are breaking down Syria. Breaking down the Arab states is Israeli strategic thinking. The 1982 Oded Yanan plan has undoubtedly been aided by ISIS. Kurds are Israel's tool to break up Iraq, which is heating up. ISIS has been Israel's tool to break up Syria to the point where Ram Ben Barak, Director General of Israel's Intelligence Ministry, is calling for the partition of Syria along sectarian lines as the only possible solution.
Any arrangement that is struck in Syria, if one is achievable, I'm not sure. I'm not sure Humpty Dumpty can be put back together again. I have strong doubts. I'm not sure Syria as a state can be reconstituted.
So you have not only Ram Ben Barak, but also Netanyahu calling for Syria to be balkanized. This is what happened with Yugoslavia during the 90s. When a powerful leader like Tito was in charge, multiple ethnic groups lived side by side in peace. After he died, These groups wanted to be independent and drop their own lines on the map. Problem is, there are resources there. Groups began fighting over what they thought they were entitled to. Then after much bloodshed, the country was partitioned into multiple states. This is exactly what Israel wants to do with Iraq and Syria. You bring down a powerful enemy, then steal the resources as the people are busy fighting with each other. Israel orchestrated the overthrow of Saddam, helped the Kurds gain independence, and are now arming them to fight against their neighbors. The situation in Yugoslavia is playing out in Iraq, where people who coexisted are now killing each other. Israeli Deputy Minister for Diplomacy, Michael Oren, said back in April, "With Syria in pieces, it's time to recognize Israel's annexation of the Golan." Everything's starting to make sense.
So what do you think of my Trump Home Mattress Collection by Serta? Finally, the same luxury and comfort I demand in my hotels.
Oh, they'll never count sheep again.
Listen, why don't you come work for me?
What do you have in mind?
Something you were born to do.
Welcome to Room 9.
Looking good, Number 9. Looking good.
Where's your dignity?
Save now on this Trump Home Luxury Suites mattress during the Serta Luxury Suite Savings Event. Now through Labor Day.
Come on, one. You and I are actually a lot alike. We're both in the sleep business.
Uh-huh.
We both work really hard.
Sure.
And we both wear wool suits.
Where does the greater Israel aspect of this plan come from? First, we have to go back to Professor Israel Shahak's book where he sources Herzl's own writings. In his Complete Diaries, Volume 2, page 711, Theodor Herzl, the founder of Zionism, says that the area of the Jewish state stretches from the Brook of Egypt to the Euphrates. The Promised Land isn't just Palestine. It includes Iraq and Syria. Herzl's quote is based on Genesis 15:18. "So the Lord made a covenant with Abraham that day and said, 'I have given this land to your descendants, all the way from the border of Egypt to the great Euphrates River.'" Israeli Justice Minister Ayelet Shaked confirms this.
בכסף מלא, שטר מחר הראשון מסוגו בעולם, ככה שיש לנו גם זכויות היסטוריות וגם זכויות משפטיות על המקום. צריך לומר כאן בפה ברור, בכל ברור לעולם, בעיקר לאום, כדאי שישמעו קצת וידעו את העובדות. יש לנו זכות מלאה על הארץ ונמשיך לבנות
Ayelet Shaked is actually a Jewish extremist. In 2014, she called for the genocide of Palestinians on Facebook. She wrote, "They are all enemy combatants, and their blood shall be on all their heads. Now this includes the mothers of the martyrs who send them to hell with flowers and kisses. They should follow their sons. Nothing would be more just. They should go, as should the physical homes in which they raise the snakes. Otherwise, more little snakes will be raised there." Instead of being reprimanded for this, Netanyahu promoted her to justice minister, just as he's done with other religious psychopaths.
15 countries in the Security Council just passed a resolution. 14 of them voted against you, and America abstained. Not a single country voted with you. The EU, the UN, the Russians, the Chinese, the US, they all view this as an illegal occupation and illegal settlements. You are completely isolated on the issue of occupation and settlements. You know that, Naftali.
Mahdi, I guess what you need to do is go back and change the Bible. You need to change the narrative of the Bible because it's all there. If you want to say that our land does not belong to us, I suggest you go change the Bible first, come back and then show me a new Bible that says that the land of Israel doesn't belong to Jews.
Okay.
And King David ruled from Jerusalem. This holy book, the Bible, contains 3,000 years of history of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. No one can change this history.
Let's take a look at King David's empire at the time of his death. Israel is described as the area under direct central administration. Iraq and Syria are described as dominions and vassal states under the kingdom's economic control, but not parts of the kingdom proper. That is clearly what they are trying to accomplish in Iraq and Syria today. And as you've just seen, the Israeli government openly believes that God promised that land to them.
is defining the future of Israel. And their stated purpose is clear. They believe in one state, Greater Israel.
In an interview with ABC's John Miller in 1998, Osama bin Laden explained why he declared jihad on the United States. We know at least one reason behind the symbolic participation of Western forces, and that is to support the Jewish and Zionist plans for expansion of what is called the Great Israel. Surely, their presence is not out of concern over their interests in the region. Their presence has no meaning to save anyone, and that is to offer support to the Jews in Palestine, who are in need of their Christian brothers to achieve full control over the Arab Peninsula, which they intend to make an important part of the so-called Greater Israel. You don't have to like Osama, but he was actually telling the truth. He was aware of the plan for a Greater Israel, which has killed over 2 million of his people. After watching the next few clips, you'll understand why Israel framed Osama bin Laden for 9/11.
Mr. bin Laden, you have declared a jihad against the United States. Can you tell us why?
The U.S. government has committed acts that are extremely unjust, hideous, and criminal through its support of the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And we believe the U.S. is directly responsible for those killed in Palestine, Lebanon, and Iraq. Due to its subordination to the Jews, the arrogance of the United States regime has reached the point that they occupied Arabia, the holiest place of the Muslims, who are more than 1 billion people in the world today. For this and other acts of aggression and injustice, we have declared jihad against the U.S. The U.S. today has set a double standard, calling whoever goes against its injustice a terrorist. It wants to occupy our countries, steal our resources, impose agents on us to rule us, and then wants us to agree to all this. If we refuse to do so, it says we are terrorists. When Palestinian children throw stones against the Israeli occupation, the U.S. says they are terrorists. Whereas when Israel bombed the United Nations building in Lebanon, while it was full of children and women, the U.S. stopped any plan to condemn Israel.
But I wrote a very political book years ago in the year 2000, The America We Deserve, and I said in that book that we better be careful with this guy named Osama bin Laden. I mean, I really study this stuff. I really find it very interesting. And even though I'm a businessman, I've always been involved in politics. I said, we better be careful with Osama bin Laden. There's a guy named Osama bin Laden. Nobody really knew who he was, but he was nasty. He was saying really nasty things about our country and what he wants to do to it. And I wrote in the book, 2000, 2 years before the World Trade Center came down, I talked about Osama bin Laden. You better take him out. I said, he's going to crawl under a rock. You better take him out. And now people are seeing that. They're saying, you know, Trump predicted Osama bin Laden, which actually is true. And then 2 years later, a year and a half later, he knocked down the World Trade Center.
When he walks into the room and you realize this guy is 6'3 or 6'4, he never raises his voice. He doesn't pound the table or use his fist. He's not a fiery orator. He's soft-spoken. But the words he was using were extremely powerful and frightening. He had three principal issues. One was to remove the U.S. military presence from Saudi Arabia. The other was to end the U.S. support of Israel, particularly as it affected negatively the Palestinians. And three was, at that time, an immediate halt to the bombing of Iraq, and even still now today, an end to sanctions that he felt adversely affected Iraqi women and children and innocents.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but the price, we think the price is worth it.
Congressman, if Congress were given an opportunity to vote on whether we should bomb Iraq, would you go along with that as long as it went through the procedures?
No, I would strongly oppose it because they're not a threat to our national security. Iraq has a third-rate army. They have no ability to wage war. Our policies are deliberately destroying the country. They can't feed their children. They're not allowed to have medication. There was a story in today's paper where one of our private charity groups was being fined because they were trying to get medicines in to the Iraqi people.
The UN reported that as many as 576,000 Iraqi children may have died since the end of the Persian Gulf War because of sanctions. Saddam invaded Kuwait and lost the war, but sanctions were kept going because of the lie that he had weapons of mass destruction. Israel knew Saddam had no WMDs. They destroyed his nuclear reactor in 1981, also killing French scientists in the process. Netanyahu wrote about sanctioning Iraq in all three of his books. Let's take a look at his 1995 book, Fighting Terrorism. Even though over 500,000 children were starved to death, he calls the sanctions a measurable success. Remember that 1998 PNAC document calling for regime change in Iraq? Well, the Project for a New American Century was founded by Bill Kristol and Robert Kagan, who are both American Jews. In 1998, they wrote an article titled, Bombing Iraq Isn't Enough. It is clear that Mr. Hussein wants his weapons of mass destruction more than he wants oil revenue or relief for hungry Iraqi children. They knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. They were intentionally starving those children to death. These psychopaths will often bring up the Holocaust and use that to play the victim while they starve to death hundreds of thousands of children. They also wrote, if 5 weeks of heavy bombing in 1991 failed to knock him out, 5 days of bombing won't either. Can the air attacks ensure that he will never be able to use weapons of mass destruction again? The answer, unfortunately, is no. Even our smart bombs cannot reliably hit and destroy every weapons and storage site in Iraq, for the simple reason that we do not know where all the sites are. After the bombing stops, Mr. Hussein will still be able to manufacture weapons of mass destruction.
2 decades ago, it was possible to thwart Saddam's nuclear ambitions by bombing a single installation. But today, nothing less than dismantling his regime will do. Because Saddam's nuclear program has fundamentally changed in those 2 decades. He no longer needs one large reactor to produce the deadly material necessary for atomic bombs. He can produce it in centrifuges the size of washing machines that can be hidden throughout the country. And I want to remind you that Iraq is a very big country. It is not the size of Monte Carlo. It is a big country. And I believe that even free and unfettered inspections will not uncover these portable manufacturing sites of mass death.
Do you have any new evidence of Iraq's weapon capabilities, nuclear capabilities?
I cannot give you even an oblique reference to information in the last 3 years because I'm busy going around the world visiting Washington. I'm not.
Well, we appreciate you being.
I'm not prying into privileged dossiers.
The plan was always to bomb Iraq back to the Stone Age, destroy the infrastructure, destabilize the country, and drive refugees to Europe. Here's an interview Osama bin Laden had with Pakistan Daily on September 28, 2001, translated by BBC. I have already said that we are not hostile to the United States. We are against the system, which makes other nations slaves of the United States, or forces them to mortgage their political and economic freedom. This system is totally in the control of the American Jews, whose first priority is Israel, not the United States. It is simply that American people are themselves the slaves of the Jews and are forced to live according to the principles and laws laid by them. So the punishment should reach Israel. In fact, it is Israel which is giving a bloodbath to innocent Muslims, and the U.S. is not uttering a single word.
If there is a message that I may send through you, I address the mothers of the American troops. To these mothers I say, if they are concerned for their sons, then let them object to the U.S. government's policy.
Bush was the front man. 20 years before Bush was in office, Netanyahu published books calling for war with all these countries. In 1996, 5 years before Bush was in office, American Jews officially planned to destabilize Iraq for Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. Then they went on to work for Bush. Even Bush's speechwriter David Frum was a Jewish neocon. Benjamin Netanyahu is the founder of the War on Terror, which has killed millions of people based on lies. He was the one who first introduced the War on Terror at the Jerusalem Conference on International Terrorism in 1979. He admits this in his own book. The Jerusalem Conference on International Terrorism was convened by the Jonathan Institute on July 2nd to the 5th, 1979, to focus public attention on the grave threat that international terrorism poses to all democratic societies, to study the real nature of today's terrorism, and to propose measures for combating and defeating international terror movements. The current threat promises to become intolerable when terrorists gain access, as they show every sign of doing, to weapons of mass destruction, or when they gain control of whole peoples and governments and establish themselves as de facto terrorist states. In the face of such paralysis, pusillanimity, and impotence, the Jerusalem Conference was convened to begin the formation of an anti-terror alliance in which all the democracies of the West must join. The purpose of the War on Terror is for the West to fight all of Israel's wars for them. Trump is now leading this effort, just as Bush did.
Obviously, we'd like to see a regime change, at least I would, in Iran, just as I would like to see in Iraq. The question now is a practical question. What is the best place to proceed? It's not a question of whether Iraq's regime should be taken out, but when should it be taken out? It's not a question of whether you'd like to see a regime change in Iran, but how to achieve it. The application of power is the most important thing in winning the war on terrorism. If I had to say, what are the three principles of winning the war on terror? It's like, what are the three principles of real estate, the three L's, location, location, location? The three principles of winning the war on terror are the three W's, winning, winning, and winning. The more victories you amass, the easier the next victory becomes. The first victory in Afghanistan makes the second victory in Iraq that much easier. The second victory in Iraq will make the third victory that much easier too, but it may change the nature of achieving that victory. It may be possible to have implosions taking place. I don't guarantee it, Mr. Turney, but I think it makes it more likely, and therefore I think the choice of Iraq is a good choice. It's the right choice. Yeah.
The director of Mossad, Yossi Cohen, also admits that Iran is the primary objective. It's the biggest country out of Israel's enemies and also has the biggest prize. If they can accomplish regime change in Iran, they get their pipeline back and all that oil starts flowing to Israel again. The Mossad, the intelligence agency who did 9/11, meets with the president's team to brief them on what to say about war with Iran and Syria.
All nations of conscience must work together to isolate Iran, deny it.
The mainstream media, which is in fact controlled by Jews, something they brag about, is pushing the exact same propaganda for Iran that they did for Iraq.
The attacks are connected to Al-Qaeda, but is Iran pushing the terror buttons?
Al-Qaeda is in Baghdad.
American officials say Tehran is forging ties with Al-Qaeda.
There were connections and discussions between senior Iraqi leaders and senior Al-Qaeda members.
Iran is playing together with Al-Qaeda.
Iran continued to defy the UN by refusing to answer questions about its nuclear program.
Saddam Hussein has no intention of cooperating with the United Nations.
Iranians are moving forward with their nuclear program quicker than expected.
Saddam's illegal weapons program is going strong right under the inspector's noses.
Israel has got caught committing false flag terrorism against the United States and Britain multiple times. The King David Hotel bombing in 1946. Operation Susanna, 1954, also known as the Levant Affair. The attack on the USS Liberty, 1967. The Mossad's motto is, by way of deception, thou shalt do war. 9/11 was a false flag to start the Iraq War. And Israeli lobbyist Patrick Claussen is openly calling for a false flag killing Americans so that a war with Iran could be started.
I frankly think that crisis initiation is really tough. And it's very hard for me to see how the United States president can get us to war with Iran. Which leads me to conclude that if, in fact, compromise is not coming, that the traditional way of America gets to war is what would be best for U.S. interests. Some people might think that Mr. Roosevelt wanted to get us into World War II, as David mentioned. You may recall we had to wait for Pearl Harbor. Some people might think Mr. Wilson wanted to get us into World War I. You may recall he had to wait for the Lusitania episode. Some people might think that Mr. Johnson wanted to send troops to Vietnam. You may recall he had to wait for the Gulf of Tonkin episode. We didn't go to war with Spain until the USS, until the Maine exploded. And may I point out that Mr. Lincoln did not feel he could call out the Federal Army until Fort Sumter was attacked, which is why he ordered the commander at Fort Sumter to do exactly that thing which the South Carolinians had said would cause an attack. So if, in fact, the Iranians aren't going to compromise, it would be best if somebody else started the war. I mentioned that explosion on August 17th. We could step up the pressure. I mean, look, people, Iranian submarines periodically go down. Someday one of them might not come up. Who would know why? We are in the game of using covert means against the Iranians. We could get nastier at that.
I am Dani Dayan, the Consul General of Israel to New York.
This flag was in the World Trade Center. And eventually it was recovered by the YPD. And it landed in Mayor Bloomberg's office. And Mayor Bloomberg decided to present it to President Shimon Peres. President Peres decided wisely that it should stay in Israeli territory in New York City. It has significance for me in so many levels, Resilience, anti-terrorism, the bond between Israel and the United States of America, especially New York in particular. It has survival. It has really so many levels of significance that it really, I think, it's my main source of strength.
Right, that's the view from the Palestinian side. Joining me now here in the BBC World Studio is the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, who's in London at the moment. Mr. Barak, welcome to BBC World. First, your reaction, having heard what's happened. At least four planes have been hijacked, and there may be more.
The world will not be the same from today on. I don't know who is responsible. I believe we will know in 12 hours. Bin Laden sits in Afghanistan. There is a source
but
of
who else
terror.
Can you identify, though? Because we're not saying he's responsible for this necessarily.
No, we don't say that he's responsible. Every simple step, crossing borders or going on a plane or on a ship, will become more complicated. It's a time to launch a operational, concrete war against a terror, even if it takes certain pains from the routine activities of our normal society. This is the time to deploy a globally concerted effort led by the United States, the UK, Europe, and Russia against all sources of terror consistently along 6 or 10 years. Iran, Iraq, Libya, North Korea. This is the only way. Without this clarity of purpose, there will be no world order, no world order possibility.
Jared Kushner is Trump's Jewish son-in-law, who he appointed senior advisor to the president. His job is to broker a peace deal between the Israelis and Palestinians. Trump said to Kushner, "If you can't produce Middle East peace, nobody can." In reality, Kushner is literally the worst person Trump could have chosen for the job. There's huge conflicts of interest here. Kushner is financing settlements, which are illegal under international law. Settlements are essentially land theft. Israel is illegally occupying the West Bank. bulldozing Palestinian homes, forcing those people to become homeless, then building neighborhoods where only Jewish people can live.
What's down the hill? 28 brand new homes being built in my yeshuv. God gave me this land a few thousand years ago, and I came back and claimed it.
This is institutionalized racism. Just imagine if this was done to Jewish people. Kushner also finances the IDF, which is notorious for war crimes. After Elor Azaria was caught on film executing a Palestinian, Deputy Defense Minister Eli Ben-Dahan proposed a bill that would extend the immunity privilege granted to IDF soldiers for actions committed during military operations, basically a license to kill. Rabbi Ben-Dahan, who proposed this bill, is another Jewish supremacist. He publicly said in 2013 that Palestinians are like animals, they aren't human. They don't just hate Palestinians, they have the same view for all non-Jews. A Jew always has a much higher soul than a Gentile, even if he is a homosexual. Ben-Dahan was appointed Deputy Defense Minister by Netanyahu, joining his regime of racist thugs. These are the people who are telling us that Hitler was evil. Kushner is also financing Chabad Lubavitch, who are the spiritual leaders of the Israeli government. They make no attempt to hide their Jewish supremacism.
A local rabbi is under fire today for statements he made that some say promote extremism. Rabbi Manis Friedman from St. Paul was apparently answering the question, how should Jews treat their Arab neighbors? He told Moment magazine, quote, the only way to fight a moral war is the Jewish way. Destroy their holy sites. Kill men, women, and children.
Chabad rabbi Manis Friedman does not believe in Western morality. He endorses killing civilians and children and shooting first before you even know if they're going to shoot at you. He also said, the first Israeli prime minister who declares that he will follow the Old Testament will finally bring peace to the Middle East. This describes Netanyahu 100%. When he says peace, that means ruling the world from Jerusalem. He justifies his statements by sourcing the Torah, Deuteronomy 2:34. At that time, we took all his towns and completely destroyed them, men, women, and children. We left no survivors. Thou shalt not murder applies only to a Jew killing another Jew. Rabbis Yitzhak Shapira and Yosef Elitzur wrote a book about this called King's Torah, which became an Israeli bestseller. Here's the Jewish Daily Forward's article on Chabad Rabbi Yitzhak Ginsburg. He told the New York Jewish Week that halakha, or traditional Jewish law, would probably permit seizing an unwilling non-Jew for a liver transplant to save the life of a Jew. New York Times finds disproportionate role of Israelis in world organ trafficking. Coincidence, right? Kushner visits the grave of former Chabad leader to receive inspiration and blessing. On his birthday in 2007, Kushner paid $1.8 billion for the 666 Fifth Avenue building. He paid more than three times as much as the building was worth. Jared's father, Charles Kushner, was appointed chairman of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, but before being approved, he was sentenced to 2 years in prison for illegal campaign contributions, tax evasion, and witness tampering. He got the last charge by paying a hooker to have sex with his brother-in-law, then sending the videotape to his sister. Charles Kushner is actually very close to Netanyahu. The Israeli media obtained Netanyahu's partly handwritten list of wealthy Americans most likely to fund his primary elections, and Charles's name was near the top. Here's Netanyahu playing soccer at the Joseph Kushner Hebrew Academy back in 1999. Netanyahu has known Jared Kushner since he was a kid, and even slept on his bed. Netanyahu is literally in bed with the Trump administration.
Can I reveal, Jared, how long we've known you? Well, he was never small. He was always big. He was always tall. But I've known the president, and I've known his family and his team for a long time. And there is no greater supporter of the Jewish people and the Jewish state than President Donald Trump. I think we should put that to rest.
Thank you very much. Very nice. I appreciate that very much.
Now, in his own life, I got to tell you something shocking, and it's actually the reason why I told all the non-Jews to stop watching this video. Here's a fact I don't really want conspiracy theorists to hear. All of Donald Trump's children are either married to or dating Jews. All of them. The most famous of his kids, Ivanka Trump, she married Jared Kushner, who's Jewish, and she converted to Judaism herself. She actually took a Jewish name, Yael Trump. Her kids, Trump's grandkids, are Jewish. They probably call him Zadie. But it's not just Ivanka. Donald Jr. is married to Vanessa Hayden, who's Jewish. Eric Trump is married to Lara Unaska, who's Jewish. They married under a Jewish chuppah or wedding canopy at Mar-a-Lago, an exclusive club that used to ban Jews until Trump filed a massive lawsuit against them against to let the Jews in. And then there's Tiffany Trump, Donald Trump's other daughter by Marla Maples. She's not married yet, but she's dating a Jewish man named Ross Mechanic. Trump has one more kid with Melania. His name is Barron. He's just 10, so it's not yet five kids out of five who were with Jews, but I wouldn't bet against Barron dating a Jew, would you?
Ehud Barak mentioned plans for the TSA and the Patriot Act 1 hour after the North Tower collapsed. Who wrote the Patriot Act? Co-author of the Patriot Act was Michael Chertoff. Chertoff is an Israeli national through his parents. Both his parents are Israelis. His father, Rabbi Gershon Baruch Chertoff, was a Talmud scholar. If you don't know what the Talmud is, it's in your best interest to look it up. His mother, Livia Eisen Chertoff, was the first airline hostess for El Al Airlines. She was also a founding member of the Mossad. She participated in Operation Magic Carpet, the famous airlift of Yemenite Jews to Israel. This was a highly complex and dangerous rescue campaign. Operatives of the Mossad Aliyah Beth were dispatched to Yemen to organize the operation, which was kept secret and revealed to the media only after completion. Source: Strategic Intelligence Volume 1 by Loke Johnson, former special assistant to the chair of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence Oversight. The Patriot Act was written by someone connected to the Mossad. The Patriot Act was a result of 9/11, which was orchestrated by the Mossad. In 2005, Chertoff became Secretary of Homeland Security. Before that, he was Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division at the Department of Justice, where he traced the 9/11 terrorist attacks to Al-Qaeda. In that position, he oversaw the investigation of the 9/11 terrorist attacks and declared no investigative interest in the Israeli detainees, resulting in their release. His brother, Benjamin Chertoff, was also involved in the cover-up. He was part of Poplar Mechanics 9/11, debunking the myths, claiming that fire brought down all three buildings. His wife, Meryl Chertoff, served on the board of the ADL New Jersey and chaired its Civil Rights Committee. The ADL is an organization of Jewish bullies who try to defame anyone critical of the Israeli government.
Vans in the area, white vans. In one case, a van was picked up by police and people arrested at the access to a major bridge. The van was filled with explosives, and the two people in it were Israelis. In Bergen, New Jersey, same day, a van with several people in it, had set up cameras. Before the first plane hit, they were filming the Twin Towers, and they were celebrating. High fives. It was a good thing for them. Residents called police. Police arrested them. All five were Israelis. All of the Israelis who were apprehended in those vans were later released in about 2 months at the direction of Michael Chertoff, then the second director of Homeland Security, a dual U.S.-Israeli national.
What's your general viewpoint about people who think the federal government was involved in 9/11?
I think that that's in the same category as Holocaust denial and those people who still aren't convinced that President Obama was born in Hawaii.
According to some estimates, we cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
$2.3 trillion, with a T.
Hello, good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
You mentioned the September 10th, 2001 mindset. That made me nervous. I was wondering if the missing $2 trillion plus that Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld reported on September 10th, 2001, you know, where those trillions went. Did you all ever find it?
I have to say, I must have missed that news report about the missing trillions.
The World Trade Center Security was an Israeli-owned company. Security at all three of the airports from which the four aircraft on 9/11 departed, ICTS, was an Israeli security company. That security company, by the way, also had security at the airports in Paris and Amsterdam later, from which the so-called shoe and underwear bombers departed.
After the underwear bomber got through ICTS, the Israeli airport security company, Chertoff was all over the media advertising body scanners, without actually disclosing his relationship with Rapiscan Systems, who manufactures the machines. He is profiting from these police state measures. What happened immediately after the Las Vegas shooting? In the future, we may start seeing metal detectors / body scanners in hotels, casinos, schools, etc. The Jewish billionaires who are pushing this are also financing Trump. In his 1995 book, Fighting Terrorism, Netanyahu wrote, "Restrict ownership of weapons. Tighten gun control beginning with registry of weapons." Undoubtedly, the leaders of the United States in particular could be subjected to a barrage of criticism that they are curtailing civil freedoms and that they are overreacting. They should reject this criticism. The United States has given Israel over $250 billion of taxpayer money to colonize Palestine. In return, Israel is trying to disarm Americans. There is no greater slap in the face than this.
It's a crucial prerequisite for the building of the Promised Land. And we are deeply grateful for all that we have received from the United States, for all that we have received from this chamber, from this body. But I believe there can be no greater tribute to America's long-standing economic aid to Israel than for us to be able to say, we are going to achieve economic independence. We are going to do it. In the next 4 years, we are going to begin the long-term process
of gradually reducing the level of your generous economic assistance to Israel. And I'm convinced that our economic policies will lay the foundation for total self-reliance and great economic strength.
Netanyahu will go on camera and thank Americans for the increased military aid, while plotting to disarm Americans. He brings up Israeli gun control, but doesn't tell you the reality of it. The Israeli government allows Jews to own guns, while non-Jews can't own guns. The Israeli government passed a law sentencing Palestinians to 20 years in prison for throwing stones. They have the Palestinians disarmed and are straight up stealing their private property. These are the people that are trying to take your guns away. Israeli Justice Minister Eilat Shaked, who used Facebook in 2014 to promote genocide against Palestinians, is leading her government's successful efforts to press Facebook and Google to censor content. Facebook complies with 95% of Israeli requests to remove inciting content, while YouTube complies with 80%. According to Eilat Shaked, any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. She even went as far as saying that U.S. criticism distorts reality. The Israel Anti-Boycott Act. They are trying to make it illegal to boycott Israel in the United States. Violations would be subject to a minimum civil penalty of $250,000 and a maximum criminal penalty of $1 million and 20 years in prison. This is in violation of the First Amendment, punishing Americans based solely on their expressed political beliefs. 45 senators and 237 congressmen signed on to this bill when it was announced. The people who want to take away your rights are homicidal maniacs whose policies have killed millions. In the two parts of this documentary, I included as much evidence as possible so that even someone who is new to all this will have no doubt what's going on. Thanks for watching. Share this information. We all need to get more active, and if every person watching this does, we'll change public opinion and then bring down these bastards who rule over us.
When I become president, the days of treating Israel like a second-class citizen will end on day one.
Shoulders mow with tears, you're